Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Real Spoilers, powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Rosebud. Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
TalkSTL.com, Real Spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the war room of the O'Keefe Think Tank, this is Real Spoilers, episode 147, Hateful Eight.
Oh, yeah.
Quentin Tarantino, his eighth movie. And it actually has eight in the title.
It does.
Do you think that he like originally wrote the script for seven people, and then he's like, well, damn, I got to put an eighth person in there because of my
I don't think so, because there's like 10 or 12 characters.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in this.
I haven't even ever thought about who the Hateful Eight are. Like, I never even thought about it, actually. So
it was, well, we'll get into it, but yeah. It's all of your main characters, except for the people that you see in the flashback.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you go down the list, you have Samuel L. Jackson, Kurt Russell, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Walton Goggins, Demian Beecher, I guess I'm saying that right, Tim Roth, Michael Madsen, Bruce Dern.
There's your eight.
And that's the eight they're listed on, the order they're listed in IMDb, and then you get to the James Parks, who plays the guy who's driving the wagon.
OB.
So I'm assuming he doesn't count, so
right.
Anything after that.
Okay.
But then that means Channing Tatum isn't one of them, which seems kind of like
right.
He should be.
You think that he's got to be.
True.
Well, the girl probably isn't.
The girl?
She's the main character.
She's the most hateful of all of them.
But is she part of the... I just, that's what I'm wondering. I don't get who he's classifying as the Hateful Eight. Like, is it the people that are trying to save her, to kill her? Like, is there... What's his formula? I just don't know what...
I don't know.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning.
Let's...
So, Chapter 1, yeah. Last Stage to Red Rock, Joe.
So, if you know anything about Quentin Tarantino, is that most recently, actually, I feel like his films probably from...
Inglourious Bastards.
No, I would even say Death Proof have become dialogue-driven. Not that they always have, but
hold on.
I don't mean like that they always haven't been, but like you have that scene in Death Proof where they're sitting around a table.
You have that scene in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, but that scene is shorter. those scenes are getting longer and longer and longer just because he's telling more stuff. That's not what I'm saying.
He did that diner scene with the dialogue in Death Proof. Okay.
Yeah, right. But I mean, like you know as well as I do, that scene in Death Proof goes on for a while.
I hate that movie.
I like
that's my least favorite movie of his.
Really?
Ever.
Oh, see.
I wanted to tell you. Yeah, I mean, you guys don't like Jackie Brown as much as the others.
Jackie Brown's probably my least favorite.
I haven't seen it since it came out,
forever.
I mean, Jackie Brown, I think, is a good movie, but I think there's a reason why Death... I like the idea, and I think Planet Terror was way better than Death Proof, but I just thought Death Proof was boring. I mean, okay, Kurt Russell's cool. I'm not saying there aren't cool parts of Death Proof, but I think overall the movie
That whole scene with Zoe Bell on the hood of that car.
Yeah, that's a cool
fantastic.
Scene for sure with Kurt Russell and her. Yeah, but I don't know. Where it starts for me, where Quentin Tarantino, again, I love Tarantino. I mean, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs. I mean, True Romance is one of my favorite films of all time. He wrote that to make Reservoir Dogs. So I'm a huge Quentin Tarantino fan, but where I saw a visual change and a filmmaking change where he just seemed to become a better filmmaker technically was Inglourious Basterds. Like,
I would
something
agree.
Clicked, and it just, like, from Inglourious Basterds on, every film has been better than the last, better looking, better. You know, I think
personally, for me, I think it was when he started doing quote unquote genre movies. So, I mean, like, Kill Bill is an old Japanese movie. Kill Bill 2 is a spaghetti western,
and those are awesome movies. Don't
yeah,
get
but
me wrong.
To me, that's the flip is when he started doing genre movies. So then obviously he did a war movie, he's done a western. I don't really know what you would classify this as,
but you know, something
I guess
changed.
A western,
maybe.
What
a western.
Yeah but to me, like, Inglourious Basterds, I mean, I don't know, tell me if you guys disagree, but it was more artistic. Like, Inglourious Basterds is where I saw, like, more art. Again, all this is art, it's theater, but you know what I mean, like, visually, like, beautiful. Those
more,
those wide sweeping scenes in the beginning,
yeah,
of Inglourious Basterds,
I would agree.
I'm just
with
like that to me was like, wow.
So
this
to
guy,
me, gotta wait. Well, I think what you're saying and why you're having a hard time delineating, because it's not like he's never been a visual director.
No,
is that I think early on his visual panache was driven by the camera.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It was camera angles,
right?
Mm-hmm. And it was the way he, you know, the way he would frame a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think when he started getting into these bigger movies, it became more about the way he constructed a
I
shot
would agree
visually.
Yeah.
Like, it was about
his cinematography played more of a,
yeah, where you know, originally it was like, it's this cool shot with the cameras in the trunk, and
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean, and or you know. In Reservoir Dogs, when the camera's looping around him, it's like the camera is a character.
Right.
And the camera has become less of a character,
mm-hmm.
and it's more of an omnipotent eye than
I
it had
agree.
Been previously.
Yeah.
And so it's more about, you know, there's lots of, like, great visuals in this, but it's more about him capturing scenery in a dramatic way, which is why he wanted
well.
A 70mm. But we'll get into whether or not
right.
that was worth it.
Yeah.
I'm leaning towards no.
So the movie opens.
Tough.
Well,
I
want to your point about, just real quick, about the big sweeping shots. He starts that in Kill Bill. Like, in Kill Bill, that scene where she's looking like Bruce Lee on a motorcycle and she's driving through the streets of Japan. You know, he's doing that big shot where she's going around the city. So, like,
yeah.
To your point, I think that's where it starts.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. To be, yeah, Kill Bill-ish to Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, Inglourious Basterds seems bigger and different to me, but he's a great filmmaker, no doubt. But
but you see that a lot with filmmakers where they kind of do something smaller in one movie. Like, I know you're saying this is bigger, but I mean, like, it's a smaller element
yeah.
of a film.
I think it was a test.
And then they extrapolate.
Right, exactly.
That's what
he
I think.
Learned on Kill Bill.
Like, the famous one, the one I always think of the most is Woody Allen with Annie Hall. Like, the Woody Allen, like, fans always, because Woody Allen kind of went under a dramatic turn after Annie Hall.
Yeah.
But, so the debate among Woody Allen fans has always been, is Annie Hall his last comedy or his first drama?
Interesting.
Because as funny as Annie Hall is, it's also a very dramatic movie. This, you know, and it ends on a downbeat,
right.
And which is unusual for a romantic comedy. And so, you know, and so, and then he rolls into Manhattan, and then I think what Stardust Memories and Interiors, and you get a lot more of the dramatic stuff from it. And it's a while before you see a flat out comedy from Woody Allen again.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's like 10 or 15 years, maybe, you know?
Huh.
And Broadway Danny Rose, but it was like a different type of comedy, you know?
It wasn't his kind of traditional, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. And so, I think that, you know, I get what you're saying, that it's like he was kind of like, oh, that'd be fun to play with.
Right.
You
and
know?
Then it works, and he's like, I'm going to keep doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
So
this movie starts with a giant shot of what it looks like a crucifix, and it just kind of pulls out and pulls out and pulls out and pulls out, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and finally we see the stagecoach, and it's coming down like this, you know, it's all snowy, and then we are introduced to four of our characters who we'll see for a while. So Sam Jackson is standing in the middle of this road, and the buggy kind of stops, and they have this interaction, and now we're introduced to OB, who is driving the stagecoach, and then we're also introduced to Kurt Russell, who is just rocking the greatest mustache ever on film.
Kurt Russell is awesome in this movie.
Kurt Russell
I'm
is
so
awesome
glad,
in anything
I'm
that
so
he's
glad
in.
That Kurt Russell's back, though. You know, like,
I love Kurt Russell.
Love seeing him in Furious 7, right? Is the
yeah.
seventh one. You know, he's in Furious 7. He's doing, he did Bone Tomahawk.
Did you see Bone Tomahawk?
I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it's good.
That's intense.
But it's like, I
he's
love.
He's going to be Star-Lord's dad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Guardians 2.
Supposedly. He's never seen Guardians of the Galaxy, which is interesting.
Man, whatever. He's Kurt Russell, whatever. Yeah.
But, you know, this guy's been around forever, and obviously, I mean, he's done some amazing films, and I love that he's coming back. And
the computer wore tennis shoes. Let's not forget that.
Always a good one.
Yeah.
Overboard.
Yeah. I said some amazing films. Okay.
Overboard's great. Yeah. I love Overboard.
Is that where he met Goldie Hawn?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the weightlifting
one? Where he's all stretchy.
I don't know.
His arms get all stretchy.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know.
It was a Disney flick, though.
Stretch Armstrong? Yeah, yeah. Is he Stretch Armstrong?
No. Is he Stretch Armstrong?
No, they didn't have made one of those.
I don't know, but he was a Disney kid for a while.
But we get it. You love Kurt Russell. He's awesome. Yes. So I did love his character in this movie.
Yeah, so we learned that Sam Jackson's character, Major Marquise Warren, is a bounty hunter, or the head hunter, and he's got this pile of bodies. And they kind of pull up, and he's like, look, we're all going to the same place. Can you give me a lift?
So they get stuck in this huge blizzard.
They're trying to beat a blizzard.
Right.
To get to Red Rock.
So John Ruth is taking Daisy Domaguew to be hung. She is this wanted.
Yet. Yeah, we know that she's wanted. We don't know why or who she is. Just that Kurt Russell, who they call the hangman, is getting her to this town so she can hang. And he can collect the bounty.
Right.
And his deal is, as we learn, is that if there's a bounty on your head and it's either dead or alive, he will always bring you in alive because he wants you to hang.
Yeah.
Hence his nickname.
Yeah.
So they kind of strike a deal. It turns out that there's a little bit of a connection between Marquise and John.
And this takes place right after the Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah. The Civil War is over.
Very recently.
Right. Over. So
the materials all seem to say 6 or 8 years. I don't know where they.
Okay.
6 or 8. Yeah. Between 6 and 8. Like 6 or 8. It's weird. Like,
either or.
Like there's something in the movie that signify that's a time marker. I could not figure out what it is.
I don't know what it is.
But that. Or maybe there are two. Conflicting things in the movie.
He's done that before, but I
couldn't figure out what they were.
Okay. Neither could I. So they have this interaction, and it turns out that they have this past history where they kind of knew they hung out at one point. So
they
they're acquaintances.
He sees him. Like, people start to recognize each other, which is kind of cool that you would have all these characters cross paths. And as soon as Samuel Jackson walks up,
you mean a Tarantino movie where everybody kind of knows each other?
Is that?
Yeah.
But I love it that you know, the hangman, he's like, hey, I know you, you
right,
know?
Right, right.
And they's like, oh yeah, we shared a dinner.
It seems like a plot device, but if you think about it, it's
back then, it may not have been.
It's the early 1870s.
Right.
You're in Wyoming, a very sparsely populated state.
Yeah.
And they're going to one of the few
towns
in the state. So like it would, you know what I mean? Like it would stand to reason that if they were all in that state, they could be converging.
Correct.
On roughly the same point.
Especially right. when people are jet setting around the U.S. I mean, you live in.
Especially when they're all there for kind of the same reason.
Yeah. There's an underlying thing that's going to bring all these people. That's going to bring all these people together. So, you know, Kurt Russell being super cautious is just kind of like, look, we'll give you a lift. But you got to give OB your guns, and you can ride in the back, and you ride on that side, and you know, do whatever. So they kind of pick up and they take off. They have some interactions that turns out that Sam Jackson's character has a letter from Abraham Lincoln. So Kurt Russell's kind of like, do you still have it? And he's like, yeah, I still have it. He's like, look, I know you don't like taking it out of that envelope, but like, I'd like to read it. And he was like, all right. So they gives him the letter, and it's just kind of this moment where he's like, oh man, like it's weird because. There's so much affinity for Abraham. Like, there's so much love for Abraham Lincoln in this movie where they're just kind of like, oh, that letter just gets me right in,
to be fair, this is obviously pre-internet. You know, there's not a lot of...
That's true.
There's not a lot of information out there about the president. And if you have a letter from the president, it's not like Abraham Lincoln was retweeting you back in these days. You know what I mean? So you didn't get a lot of interaction with the president of the United States. If he wrote you a letter, that's a damn big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And then like the last line of the letter is just, you know, like Mary Todd's a calling, and like Kurt Russell's like, he gets me every time.
Old Mary Todd's a calling.
Here you go.
And then Daisy Domergue spits on the letter.
And this is great. And so the whole time, so John Ruth has Daisy Domergue handcuffed because he doesn't want her to escape, obviously. You know, is it a $10,000 bounty on her head. So when she spits on the letter, Samuel Jackson's character punches her off the stagecoach and John Ruth goes flying
There's
out.
A, Jennifer Jason Leigh gets punched in the face a lot in this movie.
Yeah, it's
I wasn't sure how to take that.
It was tough because like I was thinking it was the 1870s, and she.
But it was also definitely oftentimes played for laughs.
But I also
the crowd I saw it with was laughing at it.
I definitely got some laughs in my crowd as well. I just feel like she was such a like the character was so bad.
The character I think is probably the most hateful of the hateful.
Yeah,
eight.
Right.
And so it's easy to despise her, but like that she is just.
She gets the crap kicked out of her.
She gets beat up repeatedly. She gets like lots of like gross things
happen to her
thrown in her face repeatedly. Like
right,
it's
right.
just like, and I'm just like, oh, I don't get what we're establishing here.
I can only think, I mean, cause there are, I mean, just like Django, they use some colorful language.
Yeah.
A lot. And I just have to think that like, it's maybe what Tarantino thinks back then was like. You know?
Well, and most Westerns normally like just remove race from the equation.
This one does not.
No.
And neither did Django. Like Django did not hold anything back either.
Yeah. Where in Django it was like here it's more of it's in the background. I mean, it's
I guess
compare it to Django.
Right, cuz Django is kind of front and
about,
center the entire time.
About,
it's about him. Yeah.
Freed slaves. So.
Where
right.
this is more about people just living in the world where racism is
Not dead.
And you know, you got to give it to Tarantino because that's something that most filmmakers would beat around that bush. Most people would not use the same language, but I guarantee that's exactly what it was like back then. I mean, it was just people.
Probably.
I mean,
you're not wrong.
You just had the Civil War where half of the country was for slavery.
Right.
You know, it's interesting that most filmmakers would not probably use this colorful language. They would just kind of like sweep that to the side, and Quentin Tarantino tries to make it as factually accurate for the times as possible.
That's probably true. And he's also
it's
that
hard to say because he's so stylized. I'm not saying that racism wasn't prevalent and frighteningly casual back then,
right?
But I think I would pull short on saying that it's that his representation of it is historically accurate.
I don't know. I just, granted,
he's not trying to make something historically
right,
accurate.
Right, right.
That's kind of my point.
That's
you know?
True. I can see what you're saying. Yeah. So they keep going down the road, and
chapter two, son of a gun,
and they're going down the road, and this is the scene where she spits on the letter, and he punches her in the mouth.
No, that ends chapter.
Is that end chapter
that
one?
Ends chapter one. Yeah.
So they're moving right along, and this is where we're introduced to Walter Goggins, who was one of my favorite actors. I love this guy,
Walton Goggins.
Is it Goggins? Yeah. Okay, so he was in The Shield. He was on Justified.
And he was in Django.
He's
like one of the Leonardo DiCaprio's right hand man.
Yeah.
Django and him always getting to like.
He and Django have many scenes like interactions with each other. Yeah. And he turns out that he is going to be the new sheriff of Red Rock. So we meet. What's the sheriff's name? What's his name?
Mannix.
So it turns out that he is going to be the sheriff of Red Rock. He's the new sheriff of Red Rock. And Kurt Russell, in his infinite wisdom, is like, it doesn't really, like, and I'm not saying that as like he's an idiot, but like he's super not trusting of anybody.
Yeah.
So he doesn't believe that he's the sheriff. He's just trying to pawn a ride. As he says that, he's like, look, you can either let me in or, you know,
this is murder. If you don't save me,
if you don't save me. And then OB, you're going to have to go back and tell everybody that, you know, John Ruth murdered the sheriff of Red Rock. And he was like, fine, get in the car, like get in the carriage. So now all three of these gentlemen plus Jennifer Jason Leigh are in this carriage. And this is where we get a scene where it's pretty obvious that Goggins is a racist, like raging racist.
He's a former Confederate soldier.
Right.
And he was one of the Confederate soldiers who kept fighting after the war was over.
Yeah.
He's
trying to bait Sam Jackson, and Sam Jackson's not biting because,
right,
you know, he's Sam Jackson and he's super cool.
Samuel Jackson's character
fought for the North
during the Civil War. So he fought alongside some other people that we'll meet.
Correct.
So, you know, he is
right.
So just to know.
Well, this
side.
Is where we also get Sam Jackson's. We learn that there has been a bounty on Sam Jackson's head
because he had been
because he'd
been a prisoner of war. And he escaped the camp by burning it to the ground.
And not only did he burn Confederates, but he also burned Union soldiers as well. And he's been on the run ever since. And now, so at this point, the the blizzard has caught up to them. So they get to this little Mimi's haberdashery, which is where our movie will pretty much take place for the next 2.5 hours.
Chapter 3.
Right? Like, it's we figure...
Yeah,
we
it's about 45 half, or 50
it's
minutes
45,
in.
It's 45. Yeah, about 45 when
we
get there.
So
yeah.
For the rest of the movie, we are set in this...
Yeah.
Now, I thought a haberdashery was a hat store.
That's what I thought, too.
Yeah.
So is this a different type? Is it a haberdashery? Was there some spelling, or was that an old-timey?
Well, and when the one guy gets... When they get there, he's like, oh, I get it. It's a joke. Like,
oh.
Like... You know that it
because it is the
really.
Only. It's like a trading post in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
it's
they
pretty
have
much what it is.
Candy in jars, and they have
it's
all
like a
sorts
general
of
general store.
Yeah, like a general store. But yeah. I just thought, yeah, it's funny they call it a haberdashery.
Right.
And I didn't really understand the reference there, but anyway.
So all of our characters kind of jump out of the, or John Ruth and Daisy.
No, sorry, it's not. It's according to the Googles. It says haberdashery, the goods and wares sold by a haberdasher. Well, hang on. Now, what's a haberdasher? I'm like, well, that's kind of a bullshit definition. A dealer in men's clothing, a dealer in goods for dressmaking or sewing. So, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, so
okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because I was, in my head, I was remembering Christopher Guest and Spinal Tap. What would you have done if you hadn't been... he's like, I've been a haberdasher.
Haberdasher.
Do you have this in an 8? Yeah.
And then also another Samuel L. Jackson performance Kingsman. In Kingsman, I think that he sends him to the haberdashery to get that top hat because he wants
a
top hat for the party.
Okay.
So he goes to a haberdashery.
I've only seen that once. I need to pick up
so, you know, he goes, that's a dope ass top hat. Love that movie.
That's
so
good. That was,
I can't wait for
good.
That sequel.
Yeah,
but anyway, so.
So they get there and John, you know, they meet Bob the Mexican. Who kind of pops out and he's
watching
another,
the place for Minnie who
for
owns
Minnie,
this
Minnie and
store.
Sweet Dave.
Dave.
Sweet Dave, not Sweet Bob apparently. who have gone north, who've gone over the mountain to go check on Minnie's mom. And of course, like, even John Ruth and Sam Jackson are both kind of like,
they're skeptical.
This is all right. This is a little weird. It's a little strange.
Yeah, I will say I do love the premise of this movie. I love the type of movie this is, this whodunit.
So
I
that's
felt
what
like I was
that's
watching.
That's what I would call this. Like, I wouldn't call it a Western as
right.
much as like a whodunit.
And this is like if Quentin Tarantino did Clue. I mean, honestly,
that's
like
exactly
they're
what
all
this
in
is.
A house trying to figure out what's going on. Like, I just thought, I didn't know what to expect. I'm thinking, okay, this is a Western, you know, a bunch
I
of hate.
I just don't really get why this needed to be, all the hype about it being in 70 millimeter, and the movie is essentially set in a room and a stagecoach.
Yeah.
I
would agree. Like, I thought the scenes where you see them, like, coming through the mountains.
Sure,
and through the woods,
I mean, there
that
are certainly
sense.
some exterior shots that look great, but.
Right.
But for the most part...
I don't think it needed to be in it. Obviously, Quentin Tarantino's a film nerd. I think he wanted to do... Yeah, he is. Yeah,
what?
It's official. He actually just said he loves film. It's weird. But I think that he loves film. I think that he wanted... He loves film, not digital, but film.
Yeah,
film.
That's true.
And he loves
sure,
it.
Sure, Kodak is like, thank God.
He loves the medium as an art form and shooting on film. And so he wanted to do it in 70 millimeter. There are some... beautiful shots in the beginning, so when they're outside and everything looks great.
And the flashback we'll be getting to.
Yeah.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
And I agree. Ooh. And I agree that it didn't need to be shot in 70 millimeter, but what I was, before the podcast, what I was telling Tom was that, you know, when they're shooting the inside of the cabin, that 70 millimeter goes way wider and you're able to see a lot going on in the foreground and background, which actually is a testament to like the whodunit nature because
right.
you see things from different angles and you can see a character in the background while you can see an entire scene happening on the like the left two-thirds of the screen. And so again, you could frame it and put them closer together. I'm not saying you couldn't have done it, but I do really think that it tells the story well when you see this character doing that in the background and this over here. I liked it. So
yeah, when you get into some of the flashbacks and you're getting a different side of each, you know, of your story from different angles.
It is
like
what it is.
Makes...
It's not 100% needed, but I like it that it is done.
Yeah, I just thought it would be more.
Yeah.
Considering what a big deal they had.
And it's a gimmick. I mean, how often do you say, oh, this movie shot on 70 millimeter? I mean, you don't hear that anymore. So it was something for
and
them to sell.
I honestly
it on.
Didn't like how we saw it in the Roadshow version.
Yep.
And they basically, they took a regular screen and they just chopped off the bottom third of it. And there's like this kind of fuzzy bleed on the edges
correct.
Of a screen. And typically in a movie theater when they adjust, because some movies aren't shot as wide as others.
Right.
And they'll pull the curtains in so you don't see that, but you can't pull a curtain up.
No.
And so
they
like,
didn't center it?
I mean, it wasn't
wouldn't
like
it
off
have been centered,
but
so
like
there's a gap on the top.
I didn't think there was a gap. I don't remember.
I don't remember. There
we
being
saw in the same. We saw different showings, but same theater. I don't remember a gap at the top. I just remember a gap at the bottom.
Yeah, I remember. There was a gap at the bottom for me.
Yeah, and I think that was
That's because you went to a moronic theater.
Yeah, I was the only place in town showing it.
Yeah.
But I think that...
I don't think that was the proper way to present that.
I honestly think I think it might have been, because I think if you if you center it, then you're going to have that fuzzy at the top and bottom. At least now you don't have it at the top.
Right.
So, like, I don't...
Fuzzy?
Like
I don't understand.
Like it was like... It doesn't have a crisp cutoff... where the image ends, like it kind of filters. It's not super fuzzy, but there's just like a little. It's not just this hard line,
right?
Like,
you don't have a clean cut.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
And
it's, you know,
that's weird. I don't understand that, but
yeah,
it's whatever.
Well, whatever.
So all of our characters kind of so John and Daisy are trying to get into the haberdashery, and they've boarded it up. So
you gotta kick it open.
What? You gotta kick it open.
This is a running thing, and there's a reason that we'll find out why you have to kick it open.
Correct.
But yeah, there you hear yelling from inside. You gotta kick it open.
So they,
you see, Tim Roth is playing chess with Bruce Dern's character.
Correct. And then you've got Michael Madsen kind of sitting by himself.
Yeah.
And then you've got, is there somebody else?
Bob the Mexican's outside handling
the horses.
Obi's doing horse stuff.
Yeah. And then, so they all kind of walk in, and you know, he kind of says what's going on, and he's, you know, trying to figure out who everybody is. He walks over to drink some coffee. This is like,
and
this,
it's cool. We'll come to find out like why everyone's there, because that's the question. You're like, well, what are all these people? What's their story? Why are there such a mixed mash of people? And it just seems weird. And like, why are they there? But it looks very lived in, like they've been there for days. You know, they're
correct.
They're all set up the way that, you know, like they're all at home. And
so there's you know, Tarantino dialogue galore.
Oh, yeah.
This. And
again, this is a 3-hour movie taking place in one room.
Right,
so
right.
There's a lot of talking.
So, you know, there's just a bunch of interactions. So Kurt Russell goes to each individual person and is like, who are you? Why are you here? Who are you? Know, so we're getting some stories as to who these people are and why they're here. Obviously, the one that they try to make you focus on is Joe Gage, played by Michael Madsen, who's kind of sitting there and he's like, you know, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, I'm going home to see my mom for Christmas. And he's just like, you don't look like the mom type, you know? So he's going back and forth. So, and Kurt Russell knows something is up. He knows that something is amiss in this place.
Well, he also is very paranoid because he has a $10,000 bounty handcuffed to him.
Right.
So,
and people start recognizing her. Like, they're like, that's Daisy, whatever her name.
Domergue.
And he's just like, yep. And I'm taking her to Red Rock and she's going to hang. That's the scene you get in the trailer where he's like, you know, this is the deal. And she kind of like grabs her neck. And I, you know, it's one of those things where Jennifer Jason Leigh is one of those actresses that I remember being around all the time and then
disappeared. What was the last thing she did? Because I haven't heard that name
remember.
In a decade.
I don't remember.
I'm not saying she hasn't done anything in a decade, but I have not heard that name in a film.
But that's the Tarantino way, you know, like he saved John Travolta's career at one point.
And then he pissed it away again.
Yeah, right. And I think, honestly, I think he's saved Kurt Russell's career. Not to say that Kurt Russell was floundering, but he was just kind of...
Oh, I forgot she was the voice in Animalicia. Animalisa.
Oh,
what's that?
The new... No, it's the new... it's the animated movie from Charlie Kaufman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Interesting.
Huh.
All right. So, yeah, but like, Tarantino had a knack for... I mean, like I said, he saved... Like, John Travolta was done. And then he did Pulp Fiction and he was like, oh, yeah, John Travolta's back. And I think Kurt Russell, who I don't think like was floundering. Like I said, he wasn't floundering. He wasn't doing like bad movies. He just wasn't doing movies. Like he kind of stepped away.
He's Kurt Russell. He doesn't need to work. You know, he's
but
like,
I think he's the new Travolta for Tarantino. Like, I think he was in the Death Proof. He's in this. He was in another one, wasn't he? He wasn't in Django.
No.
Was he? Did he have a bit part in Django?
I think the thing is that
Fast and Furious. You know.
Tarantino has his cast of characters, you know,
he's, and
he likes to work with the same people. And Tarantino has a great eye for actors. Like he writes these roles and he knows who would be great. And he can take actors, whether they're, you know, the hottest thing around or they were the hottest thing around 20 years ago. And in his movies, they are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them. I can't really think of a movie, you know, where I go, yeah, that person wasn't that great in that Tarantino
Ving
movie.
Ving Rhames to me is the one that stands out. Like,
it's amazing.
But I mean, he's not...
He's great in Pulp Fiction.
But he doesn't do anything that's like groundbreaking.
He wrote to his strength.
Yeah,
yes,
like
exactly.
It doesn't matter. But have you ever said that person just sucked in a pool? Like in a.
No, that's true.
I mean, he
yeah.
just. I think Tarantino has an amazing. He has a love of film and a love for the art, and he just has an eye for casting and talent.
Right.
And when you're in a Tarantino movie, I mean, Jamie Foxx is hit or miss. He's done some decent movies. I love Collateral. That's one of my favorite movies of all time with Jamie Foxx.
Right.
And one of my favorite Tom Cruise roles. And so like, but I think he's very hit or miss. Jamie Foxx has done some stinkers too, but Django, that was amazing. And I think Will Smith is stupid for turning that down. I'm not saying he would have been as good, but he's stupid for turning that role down, because look at the movies Will Smith has made and
yeah.
look at how great Django was, but I'm happy he did because I think
Jamie
Foxx
is better. I've always been interested to know like who that character becomes as Will. Like if Will Smith plays that character, is that character as badass?
I think the movie would have been better with Will Smith.
I honestly do as well.
No, because here's what you're missing out. Here's what you're missing out on with Will Smith. With Will Smith, Tarantino's great about bringing actors to roles that have baggage, right? And sometimes that baggage plays to their strengths, like Ving Rhames, mm-hmm. and sometimes that baggage is counterintuitive, like John Travolta.
Right.
So we knew John Travolta as Vinnie Barbarino and Grease, and then all of a sudden he's playing this badass
assassin,
hitman,
yeah.
and it like it's jarring. And so I think as good as Jamie Foxx was in Django, and this isn't a shot against Jamie Foxx in the role because he was great, but I think Jamie Foxx brings a different kind of baggage to the role. Mm-hmm. And I think the Will Smith baggage would have been, he's the black guy white people like. He's the black guy white people aren't scared of. You know
now
what I mean?
He's killing white folks.
And so like so
yeah,
to
see
that,
that
anger and rage coming from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air,
right.
coming from Men in Black, coming from Independence Day, like I think
I can see that. That would have been interesting.
It adds a whole new subtext that Jamie Foxx, quite frankly, can't bring because that's not the career that he's built for himself.
Right, right.
He's not Parents Just Don't Understand and Nightmare on Elm Street, right? Or Nightmare on My Street,
right?
You know, and so Will Smith has always been like. Because he came up at a different time.
Yeah,
and so this isn't a shot against Will Smith, but Will Smith was packaged as like, I'm a black guy and I'm hip and cool, but I'm not so hip and cool that I'm going to scare your parents.
I'm not singing about killing cops.
Right. Yeah. And so because of that, like to see him in a role like Django, it would have been.
That's just unbridled anger.
It would have been a different statement to see somebody that has been, such a safe
Quotes. That's true.
Safe black guy.
That's an interesting
to do something so aggressive
against the grain.
I think it would have made that movie even more incendiary, and I mean that in a good way.
Right? No.
Than it already was.
Yeah.
Well, it's
that's a good point. I never thought about that. That's a great point.
Well, and like we said, when Quentin Tarantino wants to cast you, there's a reason, and he has an eye for it. So I have to trust his instincts that it would have been good.
Yeah.
But. I think
Tarantino even said, he's like, I wrote that for Will Smith. Like, I wanted Will Smith from the get.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, Will Smith just didn't do it. So he's going, you know, back to this one. He's going from person to person. And we learn that Bruce Dern is this old guy who's sitting there, just an old Confederate general. But they're trying to get you to focus on Joe Gage this entire time. So while all of this is going on, we also flash back into the barn where Sam Jackson and Bob the Mexican are kind of having their standoff, so to speak, where he's kind of calling. He's not. It was very reminiscent of the scene in Inglourious Basterds where Christoph Waltz has that sit down with the family about the Jews hiding out underneath the floorboards. Just kind of super intense, not really like. Accusing him, but just being like, look, man, something's not right.
Yeah. I will say, so Samuel Jackson's character is extremely bright and extremely just good at everything that he does. Like this may be one of my favorite Samuel Jackson roles I've ever seen him in. I love this character.
It is very reminiscent of Jules.
It's so, Jules is awesome. Jules is one bad mofo.
Yes.
You know what I mean? He is awesome, but man, I loved him in this role.
We should probably check the lineage of Jules because
that's
Tarantino.
Oh,
yeah, Tarantino.
Great.
Well, that's the deal. Is like there's always these these rumors or just, you know, theories that there is a
Tarantino-verse.
Tarantino-verse, yeah. Where, like, Jules...
Well, they're smoking Red Apple tobacco.
Correct. So, but, like, Django is somehow related to Jules as well. Like, it's all...
Hmm.
Like, okay. All of these characters are somehow related.
Or confirmed,
maybe,
or are those
no,
just
no,
theories?
No, just theories. Okay. But, I mean, like, there's factors, like, yeah. This character that he plays in this is Jules. Like, Jules is a very smart man, and he's yeah. cool, and
I don't
he's
know.
Chill.
He is not as angry as Jules was. Like,
Jules
I
came
didn't...
up in a different time, though.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying, like, Jules was just, like, he had that wide-eyed, like, he was just mad
like
in,
Django.
In Pulp Fiction. Yeah, I mean, I can no. see, yeah, I mean, but still, like, I didn't see him as, like, I didn't think he was the same as Samuel Jackson was in Django, and I didn't think he was the same as Pulp Fiction. Like, to me, this seemed original, but I just, it was one of my favorite things I've ever seen him
yeah,
done. I thought this
great.
Character, he was the star of this movie to me.
Well, he's the star of this movie anyway,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, and it's hard not to make Jules comparisons with the speech that he's going to give
yeah.
here.
Right,
with,
right.
When he's talking to
Bob the Mexican.
When it, yeah.
And he did it, so, yeah, he's pretty much calling him a lie. Like, he's asking all these questions because he's like, look, something doesn't sit right with me. And Bob, the Mexican's like, are you calling me a liar? He's like, no, I'm not calling you
I didn't.
A liar.
I, he's
I,
like,
I didn't
call you a liar.
One. Like,
yeah.
I didn't call you one yet.
Yeah, yeah. It's so well written. I love the dialogue.
This might be
this.
One of my favorite. Like, you know, we talk about Blair Witch or Paranormal Activity or things like that where we see it and then we, you know, we keep thinking about it.
Yeah.
I kept thinking
about this
since I've seen it. And I was like, this might be my favorite thing he's written. Like, I love this movie.
I think he's getting better every movie, seriously. Yeah, he was good 5 movies ago. You know what I mean? Like, he is just...
He's evolved. He's evolving as a filmmaker, which is weird. You'd think that, like, you know, after you reach, like, I don't know, your 6th or 7th movie, you're kind of done.
That have all been
like,
critically
you, right.
Praised.
Well, that's why he's been saying that he's doing 10 and
10
he's
and
done.
He's done, yeah.
Which I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I'll believe
Kevin
it until...
Kevin Smith was retiring.
Films in his blood. I just don't see him being like, I'm done making movies
now. I could see, like... I can see where you, if you run out of ideas, like if you don't want to do, like if you know, Kevin Smith went out and did Cop Out, and he was like, you know, I don't have anything going on right now, but I still like to direct,
right?
And he did Cop Out, and he was like, this is awful, I've made a mistake. So I can see where, like, if Tarantino would be the kind of guy that's kind of says, I don't have an original idea right now, I'm just gonna stop until.
Well,
I
can
one.
See him taking a pause. I just can't. I mean, he's not that old. What is he, like 50?
50 something?
Yeah. I don't see him.
I don't think he will make films.
Kill Bill 3.
I don't think he will either. Yeah.
So now we're inside, and now Bob the Mexican and Warren are now coming inside as well. And I'm trying to think.
So Kurt Russell sends the driver outside to dump all their guns into a
well.
Yeah,
he takes all the guns and he drops them in.
I like that he's like, okay, I've got this bounty.
Right.
If we're all going to be here together, you're going to have to hand over your guns. So he like disassembles them all into a bucket.
Throws them in the outhouse.
Yeah, and is it OB? He sends out there in this blizzard that is like, you know, the door is flying open. It's a crazy blizzard. He sends them outside and... Obi almost dies.
Yeah, he's like,
he comes back
don't
in.
Ever ask me to do that again.
It is a really funny scene, right. You know, and because Kurt Russell this whole time, John Ruth, this character is just very in
ruthless.
Charge. He is in charge, and he tells everybody what's going on. Like what right does he have over anyone else? But his character just tells everyone how it's going to be, what's going to happen. And so I think it's funny that he's calling throughout the movie. He's calling Samuel L. Jackson and what's the sheriff?
Walter Goggins.
Walton Goggins. Well, what's his?
Mannix.
Chris Mannix.
Chris, yeah.
He's calling them freeloaders the whole time, which is true. You know, he picked them up outside. You know, you freeloaders, he's telling them, you're going to go help stack these bodies over here and you're going to do that. I just love how he's handing out orders.
Right.
Calling them freeloaders.
He does kind of, he takes charge almost immediately. So, you know, the night is progressive. Like, look, we're going to stay here until the storm stops. As soon as this thing's done, we're going to go ahead and get out of here. But the entire time he keeps saying, I know.
Somebody
in here,
at least one of you,
is working with
like, Tom Bergoon.
You know it, I know it, and we're just gonna get through these next 2 days. If we get through them alive, great.
Yeah.
If not, we are like she's getting to Red Rock one way or the other.
Yeah. So then we get our big, and I think this is why it's hard not to make comparisons with Jules is because you get this big speech.
Yes.
From Samuel L. Jackson's
Correct.
Character, where he goes over. And he brings food to Smithers, who's the Confederate general.
Right.
And,
oh, man.
And talks
this
about
speech.
How Samuel Jackson's character has been living in Wyoming. And because there's been this huge bounty on his head, people keep coming to Wyoming looking to kill him.
Right.
And Smithers' son was one of those people.
Well, they also, is this where he kind of reveals that Smithers, like, had a, he captured an entire African, like, black northern troop of soldiers?
Like, regiment. And then just
kills them all.
Because he didn't want the trouble of taking them prisoner.
Right, right. Yeah. And his son was involved with that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And so his, and so he places a gun next to Smithers and basically starts telling them the story of when he, of how he killed his son.
Yeah, and it is like,
wow.
There are times when Sam Jackson is like snakes on a plane.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even in the Avengers a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you get
this is actor Sam Jackson. This is not paycheck Sam Jackson.
And you forget. You're just like, holy crap. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Samuel L. Jackson is a terrific actor.
Absolutely.
He is one of the best out there. And yeah, he's done some paycheck roles, but you're reminded of him in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, I mean, he's a character actor, so he's going to, you know, and even, but even his paycheck roles have been pretty good.
He's great as Nick Fury.
Yeah, I mean,
oh,
and,
yeah, no,
and,
it just,
and
he doesn't need chops.
And, he, and when
but
you say paycheck, it sounds like he's phoning it in on those roles, and he's not. Like, he does exactly what he needs to do
correct.
In those roles. It's not like
he's not like Bruce
never,
Willis.
I would say it's not like a Bruce Willis paycheck.
No, I don't mean, just he's got to make money too, you know, and but no, he's a great actor, and really everything he does, he at least is there showing up and giving 100%, not phoning
right.
it in.
So in this speech, he's kind of saying, like, look, I took all of your son's clothes. I made him, you know, walk in front of me in this knee-deep snow
for two hours
until
he collapses.
Right, and then just as he was about ready to give up, I made him come back to me, and I...
He wanted a blanket.
He wanted a blanket, and he would do just about anything to get the blanket.
So he
and
told him he would trade him a blanket for something to do with his big black Johnson.
Yes. Yeah.
And he did.
And he goes into...
part of the bargain.
He goes into detail about the blowjob.
Yeah. Smithers' son did his part of the bargain.
More than once, from what he's implying.
Yeah. He did everything and anything that he asked him to do.
Correct. Then he didn't give it to him. He didn't. Well, he gave it to him, but he didn't give him a
blanket,
and then ends up,
and then he kills,
and then he kills,
and then he kills him.
And at the climax of the story, pun intended.
I see what you
Smithers
did there.
Finally is so outraged he grabs for the gun, and then
Sam Jackson
shoots him.
Correct. And this is our first taste of quote unquote the Tarantino violence.
Yeah.
Like, there has been no violence.
I mean, there's been punches to Don McGrew's face,
right? But I mean, nothing.
But nothing. Like, over the top in terms of graphic
but this,
blood and gore.
This
right.
wasn't either. What's coming up is the Quentin Tarantino violence.
Yeah.
Now, the Bruce Dern gets a few shots.
I mean, the squibs, like the big old splashes of blood.
I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, he shoots him and he still is alive and up for a little bit, you know. But the next one is the Tarantino violence.
Bob the Mexican?
Yeah. So this is where the intermission falls. A lot of people listening to this might not have seen the Roadshow version, so if you're wondering when the intermission lands,
it's here.
Right when he shoots him dead, that's kind of like, it's like, intermission.
Correct.
Cool.
So,
and then we pick back up, and then we get this, do we know, who did the voiceover?
It sounded like Quentin Tarantino.
That's what I thought.
I thought it was Quentin Tarantino, too.
But I wasn't, because it didn't sound quite like him.
Right.
But.
No, I agree with you 100%, because I was listening to it, and I'm like, well, it doesn't have that weird Tarantino flair to it.
Yeah.
It actually sounded pretty cool, but I'm like.
Yeah, I think he was trying to play it straight.
I think he was really.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, which we know the internet is never
wrong. Can never be wrong.
That the narrator is Tarantino.
Okay.
I didn't like when we come back, all of a sudden this film
there's
has a narrator.
Whole other, well, there's a whole other part of the story that they just kind of drop us into.
Yeah, but I don't like getting introduced to a narrator, so, you know, an hour and a half into a movie.
Yeah.
So
we never heard him in the beginning?
No. There's nothing.
Huh.
It just felt
lazy. Well, either that or there was a reason where he felt that
he didn't know how else to tell the backstory,
right.
And so he just added a voiceover.
No,
which
that's true.
I'm
I
sorry,
guess that is. No, you're
that
right.
That feels
yeah.
lazy to me.
It does feel a little. Like, it did feel a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Unless something got cut where it was a narrator.
Something got
at the very
cut
beginning.
In a 3.5 hour movie.
It can happen.
I mean, it was actually a 4.5 hour movie.
Yeah. You know, I mean, no offense, but when your film's clocking in over 3 hours, you can't be like, oh, I was. I had time restraints.
No, I'm just saying maybe there was a narrator in the beginning and he didn't like it, but it was already filmed with the premise of a narrator. And then I'm just theorizing.
Yeah.
I think he's got, you know, Final Cut. Like, I think he gets to do whatever he wants.
Yeah. I'm sure the wine scenes are like, yeah, man. It's cool.
Yeah.
So that brings us to chapter 4.
Correct.
Domergue's got a secret.
Domergue's got a secret. So they're sitting there eating some stew. and we see in the back, like this is part of the voiceover where we see somebody, we see a hand,
we see a leather glove
pour poison into the coffee. The coffee that everybody has been drinking this entire time.
The communal coffee.
Correct. So I don't remember why.
I love it when Kurt Russell drinks the coffee that Bob the Mexican made, and it's just terrible, and he spits it out everywhere. Like, there's just some great acting and scenes from.
That's the thing is, Kurt Russell's so good. He's so good.
Spit take that's just awesome. Yeah. And then he goes and makes his own coffee.
But why were I don't remember why Kurt Russell and Obi were outside, because they come back in and then they go to drink some coffee, or were they just kind of milling around?
I think they were just milling around at this point.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they, you know, they both kind of take these cups of coffee, and like I'm watching it, and I was like, oh no, like Obi's gonna drink it, and then like Kurt Russell's gonna do like the takes where he's like, I thought we were gonna play that game too,
yeah.
And we don't.
We don't. He just starts drinking.
Yeah, he starts. It's little sips. So I was like, okay, maybe he's taking little
like
sips, so it's not gonna be
to
enough.
And this is the part where I'm like, oh crap, what is this gonna do? How is this gonna go
and
down?
And they almost make you forget that it's a thing.
Right.
Like they keep doing these different takes, and there's a conversation between.
It's not fast acting.
It's
poison
not
is
fast
what you mean.
Acting poison. It's so they're standing there and they're having this conversation. Like I'm trying to think like. Jennifer Jason Leigh says something, and of course Kurt Russell just straight up throws his stew into her face.
Yeah.
And then he starts to vomit blood.
Now
grossly.
This is the part where Chris Maddox calls the letter out and she's laughing at him.
Oh, so, is that what it is?
So Chris Maddox learns about the Lincoln letter.
Yeah, he hears the story of the Lincoln letter and he's like, and you believe that?
Right. He's like, no way.
Such bull.
He's like, this is total crap. There's no way Lincoln's writing this guy a letter. John Ruth asks Samuel L. Jackson, is it true?
Did you make all that up? And he goes, of course I did.
He's like, of course I made it up. And he's like,
look at me. Like, look at who I am.
Yeah.
Like, if I have this way to diffuse a situation, I'm going to take it.
Right.
If it can save my life the entire time.
He says, it got me on that stage.
It got me on the stagecoach. That's right. Yeah.
And you know, up to this point, I mean, John Ruth hasn't really been racist. I mean, you know, he seems skeptical of everyone.
I mean, he's been racist by today's standards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not by the time, he's been pretty open.
Well, actually, I don't think that's true. Like, every time she says the N word, he's like, hey, knock it off. You know, like he's been sticking up for Sam Jackson. I don't think he's generally racist at all. Does he say it a couple times? I don't know. I think he does, but it's more like in reference to other people saying it.
It's not him calling
correct.
Somebody that.
Correct.
So like at this point, then he's like, oh, I guess you really can't trust you people. And you start to see this come out where we haven't seen that character.
I also think his heart, like he's crushed, like this thing that he thought was a thing.
They
is
were
not a thing.
They were
friends.
They were forming a friendship.
Right.
And now he feels like it's all based on a lie.
Well, and Samuel Jackson's character is the only one John Ruth really trusts at this
point. Well,
he pretty much says he's the one with the gun, I'll protect your
8,000. Like, because he's got bounties on these other guys.
Yeah.
He's like, I'll protect your 8,000. You protect my 10. We'll get to Red Rock and we'll call it a day. They're just like, okay.
You just took the one person that he trusts to have a gun with him and watch his back, and he's been lying to him about something. So that's a big.
So I thought this was going to be a buddy cop movie. Like, that's where I thought we were going with this. We're not.
You have to have two people for it to be a buddy cop movie.
Well,
we kind of end up that way.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying.
Not with the cops you thought.
So
he starts vomiting. It's just one quick splurt of blood across the table.
It's a projectile vomit of internal organs.
And then OB in the corner starts hurling blood.
Starts doing the same thing.
Yeah, and he's looking at the coffee, and he's like, oh, and he realizes what's happened.
Yeah.
Now, doesn't... Manix was about to take a sip, and then as they start doing that,
and he was like, "Yeah."
And I think Daisy looks at the cup or something, and kind of gives it. You know, like she's watching him, and he just throws.
He throws it. That has nothing to do with it. So it's a pretty grotesque.
Well,
scene.
Then he vomits all. Then her and
they're,
him and Dominic start wrestling.
Oh, and he vomits in her face.
Yeah,
right
all,
in her
all
face.
Over her it's, face. Yeah. And it's not just blood at this point. Like now it's looking like entrails are coming up as well.
Chunks of his organs. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're.
Or it could be the stew that he ate.
I guess that's true.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Either way, it's gross.
And then she ends up shooting him with his
chest,
own gun. She gets his gun away.
Right. And he's he has some line just in typical Kurt Russell fashion where he's got one final line. And then she shoots him.
Yeah.
Like when she shoots him, I was like, oh, man.
Right.
I was hoping to
get a cool character.
I was kind of hoping We'll get to that. When we get to that part.
At this point, Samuel L. Jackson and Mannix force everybody against the wall.
Sam Jackson puts everybody against the wall, and then he calls Maddox back, and he was like, "Why are you trusting me?"
Because he's like, "You were about to drink that coffee."
Right. So I know you didn't poison it.
So even though they have this terrible relationship, he knows that he isn't the one that poisoned it.
Right.
It has to be one of the other guys.
So we should also say that Maddox is also wearing the dead general's coat at this point.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, "That's a pretty nice coat." So he takes it, and he's wearing this big gray. It's just one of those funny scenes where he's like,
"It's gonna be warm."
Yeah. Right.
He's not gonna use it anymore.
Sam Jackson starts to lay out his theory on what has happened.
Yeah, so this is where, I mean, yeah, just to cut to the chase, he breaks it down. You see how smart this character is.
Right.
And this whole time he's been gathering clues
and
evidence.
He's not as smart as we think, apparently, because he misses something kind of large, literally and figuratively, in a little bit.
Oh, well,
yeah.
It's pretty smart. I mean,
he's smart that he figures out. So he's going over to, like, he's like, "Look,
he
has this really good speech about the stew,
right,
where he's like, "You know, I've had this kind of stew since, and it never changes."
When someone makes stew,
the stew over here, that's the right stew. So she couldn't have left
that long ago.
A week ago. This is Minnie's stew.
And right. Minnie would never hire a Mexican.
Correct.
Right.
That's the speech.
Yeah.
Like, where he's talking about the sign above the bar. Yeah.
I love that. This is, again, a testament to Tarantino's writing. He obviously is known as a writer. He writes this amazing dialogue. I just enjoyed this writing
so much. Good.
And yeah, the whole thing about the sign where it said,
"No Mexicans, no dogs.
No Mexicans or dogs." And they said, the only reason she took that sign down, she started letting dogs in.
Right.
I mean, that writing is just
so immediate.
Incredible.
So he's like, "Do you know why she took that line down?" And Bob the Mexican is like, "No. She started letting dogs in." Blam! And like, he shoots Bob dead.
But he shoots Bob, but then he takes his two guns, points them in his head,
literally blows his face off.
Yeah. And that's the Tarantino violence.
We're off to the races.
Yeah.
With the Tarantino.
Because then he is instantly shot in the junk from below.
Correct.
Because we see that there's someone hiding under the floorboard.
Which, when I saw this name in the credits, and I was like, where is this guy going to show up?
I know. I kept waiting, like, when's he going to pop up?
Well, yeah, when they cast him, too.
I didn't even know he was casted.
Yeah,
I had
announced it. I'm like, oh, because he was like, this is the eighth guy.
Okay.
I'm like, no, that's weird. And this whole time I'm like, is he one of these guys with a big beard or
so
something?
So I thought he was the son. And then they showed the son's junk. And I was like, that's not
right.
Channing Tatum.
You know Channing Tatum's junk.
Because you recognize his junk.
I saw Magic Mike. But I was like, I don't think Channing Tatum would be like, "Yeah, I'll put my junk on screen."
Right.
Like, that's, yes.
Not at this point.
Not at this point.
Yeah.
So there's a giant gun battle.
I read an article where they were talking about when Quentin Tarantino wrote that scene, that they were worried about.
Which scene?
The blowjob scene.
Oh, yeah.
About, like, would they be able to find an actor willing to do the scene, you know? And and they said that they were at a Screen Actors Guild meeting, and with a bunch of actors that weren't that well, you know, not name actors.
Sure, sure.
And they were like, "Here's the scene, you know, would you audition for it? By the way, it's a Quentin Tarantino film." And there's this long pause. And then, like, slowly hands start going up, like, yeah, it gets a Quentin Tarantino
If I get a Tarantino credit on my resume. So at this point, we get a giant gun battle. And I feel bad for Tim Roth. If I were Tim Roth, I would try to stop doing Tarantino movies, because you get shot in the gut every time.
Unless you're a waiter.
It's true. Yeah. I forget about that. But he only did one scene.
Yeah. He did the last room, right? Yeah.
Tarantino?
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. Buscemi was the waiter. Tim Roth was the guy.
He
was robbing the diner.
Yeah. I was thinking
Buscemi was.
Four rooms.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so everybody is getting shot at this point.
Except for Michael Madsen, no gun. I got no gun,
which I thought was great.
Which is great that he didn't.
Yeah.
This is one thing they keep harkening back to, is how law abiding the Wild West was when it comes to, like, you know,
the unspoken law.
Because if you notice,
he didn't have a gun and he turned his back to him.
Correct.
So he was like, "You're going to shoot me unarmed and it's going to be in the back.
Yeah.
That's how you're going to have to do this."
Right.
But
and
like,
and
the
he
whole,
wouldn't do it.
Wouldn't do it.
The whole Samuel Jackson thing, shooting Bruce Dern's character. Like, he put the gun there and he did not do anything until he threatened his life.
Well,
and
that's kind of a callback to the movie Shane. Famous scene with...
You're doing this. Dan's not here, so I can't help.
Oh, what's his name? The guy that played Curly in the City Slicker movies.
Jack Plants.
Jack Plants.
Yeah.
Where he's like, throws the gun on the ground, and he's like, you know, pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, and, finally,
Back to the Future Part 3.
Yeah, and finally the guy goes to pick up the gun and he shoots him before he can even touch it. And he's like, you saw him.
Yeah, he went good for it.
Right. He had a gun.
Yeah.
But like, I love that how they're all very law abiding and following this stuff, you know? And so he's, so even though the sheriff, Chris Mannix, he's like, he hates this character and he says, I knew it was Joe Gage the whole time, but like still Joe Gage.
His theory, it must have been Joe Gage because he's the ugliest.
He's the ugliest. Yeah, I love that. How they kept calling that out.
It was
out,
pretty good, yeah. And so, that's the thing is like, okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, no, I was saying this brings us to chapter 5.
Correct.
The four passengers.
So
now we get our backstory.
I love this. Yeah. So now they go back and you find out why they're actually all at Minnie's.
So it turns out that Zoe Bell, who again, you actually know her more than you think you do. She was Uma Thurman's stunt double in Kill Bill 1 and 2. She was, she played herself in Death Proof. But she's kind of like, she's always going to be around in Tarantino stuff. Like Tarantino is a big fan of hers.
Yeah.
She did Ed Brubaker, who wrote comic books forever. He did a movie called Angel of Death or something. And she's in that. It's not bad.
So she's like the one that's jumping around on the stagecoach,
which is who she like in anything that you see her in. That's who she is. Like she's always bouncing around like the scene in Death Proof where she's telling about the story about, taking a picture and she's like, just a little father. You know, she's like,
She's very chipper.
So we learn that there's an old man inside. This is the flashback. So we don't know anything about Minnie's yet.
Yeah.
There's an old man inside Minnie's that wants to get out of there. But these four passengers are coming here for whatever reason.
I love the scene of them getting off the stagecoach with their boots.
Correct.
It's Quentin Tarantino. This is, again, the visual, the cinematic style. I just thought it was so cool to see. You don't see who these people are.
Right.
You know it's going to be some of the characters, but, you know, you just see each different boot, and I just really thought that was
right. I guess we should go back and say that before we get to the flashback, that Sam Jackson is kind of talking about Minnie's, and he's like, this is Sweet Dave's chair.
Right.
And, like,
This
is Sweet Dave's coat. This is Sweet Dave's chair. None of this would be here if they went. So he starts pulling back these pieces, and there's a giant
He pulls up the coat,
right.
And there's a giant blood stain.
Yeah. So,
and then he kills Bob the Mexican.
Right.
And all that, yeah.
So we're introduced to all these characters. So we see Tim Roth. We see Michael Madsen. We see
Channing Tatum.
We see Bob the Mexican.
And then we see a fourth guy.
It's Channing Tatum.
Playing Jody.
So, you know, they kind of go in, and they're all being really chill. Like they're just kind of they're making conversation with it. This is where we see Minnie and we meet Sweet Dave and we realize that Bruce Dern is there. Like Bruce Dern is the old man that's been there this entire time.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they start talking and then all of a sudden, I think Channing Tatum kind of makes a move to his pistol and then all hell breaks loose.
They kill everybody except Bruce Dern's character.
Right.
And they basically make a deal with him that they're like, look,
keep your mouth shut.
You're going to keep your mouth shut. And he's like, I don't care about you. I don't care about the people coming in here. He's like, if I live, whatever.
Right. They lay their plan out. So it,
because they like the idea of him being there because they feel that it makes it look more real.
Right.
Because he's clearly not part of their group.
Correct.
Like, there's no way this guy could be
this
part
old
of,
man is part yeah. of this group. So they lay it all out for us. It turns out that Channing Tatum is the brother of Jennifer Jason Leigh of Daisy, and they know that they're going to come this way. They're going to kill Kurt Russell and they're going to take Daisy with them and they're going to go away. They're going to escape.
During the gun battle too is when they end up shooting the lock off the door,
right?
Which is why the door
can't
has to
lock.
Yeah,
the door.
This is where it's all you see all the staging, like you said. They leave Bruce Dern there and they say you might get out of this alive and do all that. But yeah, they shoot the lock off, and so that's why they have to nail the board to the door.
Correct.
And then they clean everything up. They're cleaning up,
so they kill Minnie. There's another thing that we kind of left out where, Sam Jackson kind of walks in and he looks down into like one of the crevices of the board.
He sees like a little piece of candy.
Little jelly bean.
Yeah.
And he looks up and there's
one, it's
pretty obvious that there's something missing. There's a vase missing that was full of candy. So during the shootout, there's a girl picking up a piece of this vase and they shoot her and that blows up the
cool visual thing.
Yeah,
about
right.
The
candy,
and
going
candy
goes everywhere.
Yeah.
So they stage the place. They hide guns underneath the tables and stuff.
Right,
and then
Channing Tatum
goes down and hides
underneath the basement. And then
which brings us to chapter six,
which is the opening. I think the end of chapter five
is
Kurt Russell
when they
banging
arrive
on the door.
Yeah,
right.
And then that brings us to chapter six: Black Man, White Hell.
So. Now here we are.
Warren
has been shot in the balls.
Has been shot in the balls. He's in bed in pain.
Right.
Mannix is still alive somehow.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
He took a shot to the leg, but he's all right. Like he's not
but
dead
he's
yet.
He got a gun on Dahmer Goo.
Right.
And
Tim Roth is still alive.
Tim Roth is still alive.
And so is
once
Joe
again
Gage.
Shot in the stomach.
Golly.
And so is Joe
Just
Gage.
Gut shots. Let's feel bad for Tim Roth. So they kind of say, you know, hey, you in the basement.
They
come out.
They get. They basically say, if you don't come out of the basement, we're going to kill your sister.
Correct. So,
or something like, we're going to blow this bitch's head off.
And then as soon as he pops his head up.
No, he throws, he's like, throw your gun out. So he throws one out.
Oh, I love this line.
Yeah, yeah.
He goes, best line.
Tell him to throw the other one out or we're going to shoot. He's like,
I've only got one.
He's like, throw it out or we're going to shoot.
You better.
He's like,
whoop.
He's like,
better
oh, no, he was
it.
Like, no. I don't have another gun. He's like, well, then you better shit another gun and throw it
right now.
And of course, here comes
and then
another
one comes up. I just love it.
Actually, the best part of that is Sam Jackson kind of looks at Walter Goggins and it's just kind of like, told you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he pops out and he kind of says, like, look, we'll make you a deal right now. He's like, all you got to do is kill Warren to Maddox, to Chris. He's like, you kill Warren. You haven't done anything that isn't forgivable. He's like, we'll give you Bob the Mexican and we'll give you somebody.
Well, and Tim Roth says,
like,
I'm not gonna
last 2 days,
so you can take my body.
There's like a $15,000 bounty on me. There's like a $10,000 bounty on.
Isn't he? Don't they kill Jody almost as
well?
I thought they kill him almost as soon as he pokes his head out.
Because he starts talking about the deal, and then
I thought it was Daisy that tries to broker the deal.
I don't. Maybe I'm wrong.
I thought that you're right. He does die pretty quick. They look at each other like, "Hey, dummy," and then. And then, they blow Jody's head off.
Is that
off,
right?
Which is great.
Okay.
Which is great. Because
And then Daisy's mad at Mannix for working with a black guy because she's like, I thought you were a trustful racist.
Right.
Yeah. And
well, he starts thinking about it. Like, he's definitely said, like,
and then they start starts brokering the deal of, like, look, the dead guys, that everybody in this gang's worth 10, Jody's worth 50.
Right.
And she's like, so you've already got, like, two guys.
He goes, I can't take the Mexican. I blew his face off.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Nobody's going to believe me who he is.
Yeah. That was funny. When Samuel Jackson is like, well, he's not worth anything because nobody's going to know who he is.
Which I thought was good.
But so Mannix wants to take Jody, and she's like, no, we're taking him, and he's going to be buried.
Right.
Know?
And he's like, you know, so he kind of like, it looks like the character that we have seen throughout this entire movie starts to come back where he's like, let me listen to this for a second. So they kind of sit down and he starts listening to what they have to say. And then I'm trying to think. Oh, OK. So Joe Gage. So we learn that each one of these people are people that Sam Jackson and John Ruth would have known had they given them the real names.
Right.
So they're all part of this giant. He's like, so
they weren't pronouncing it Dahmer Goo, the gang. It was like the Jody something gang, but it was clearly
Domingue.
The name.
I'm pretty
Domingue
sure it's Domingue
is
okay.
What they were saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I wonder what, it doesn't matter. So she kind of lays out after they've killed Jody.
Yeah. He's like Jody Domingue and she's Daisy Dahmer Goo for some reason.
Cause he all loves to make weird names. Yeah. Like he's always.
At first I didn't like that name. I was like, what the hell kind of name is that? And then the more they said it, I'm like, I like that name. Like it's weird and so out there, but I'm
right.
Like, I kind of like it. Daisy Dahmer Goo. It's just so weird, but
she is goo. Like she's not attractive.
Did
at
she
all.
Always have her front teeth broken out?
No,
okay.
So Kurt Russell bust her teeth out.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't see the transition point. And then this whole scene where she's doing the deal, she's yelling and she has no front teeth. And I'm like, ooh,
that's the thing is like, she doesn't have any lines. Like she has no lines up until like the last 15 minutes.
You get punched in the face if you talk.
True.
So, you know,
like
I mean?
Until the last 15 minutes is where that character kind of comes back. And
I mean, she speaks, but she doesn't have much.
Right.
And they have an interesting relationship, though, Kurt Russell, because as mean as Kurt Russell is to her, there's also moments where he's very, like, protective of her.
Well, he's protective of his money.
Well, no, because there's moments where, like, she's got stuff on her face and he, like, wipes it off.
Oh, that's true.
I think Kurt Russell's character is a gentleman and is a law-abiding guy, and like even though he's bringing her in to be killed because she is a bad person, he still has this like gentlemanly like good person.
That's
you know
true.
What I mean?
There's a funny scene where they're trying to eat.
Yeah,
and like they both keep like jerking their hands the wrong way. So he's like, "I'm gonna uncuff you, but don't screw me over. And then she's like, can I play the guitar?
And he lets her.
And he lets her.
But then he freaks out and destroys the guitar. And
because of what she's singing.
Because she sings, she's singing a mean line basically about you're going to die.
Right, right.
And I'll outlive you.
And right, he busts the guitar.
True, but no.
He didn't know that.
Yeah.
So she kind of lays out. She kind of says, like, look, you can take me to Red Rock, but there's going to be 15 gang members there. Wait, 15 of the most ruthless gang members you've ever seen waiting for you.
This is his alternative option. He can either, you know, free her and take the bodies or be mowed down.
Right.
By
and then
gang.
He kind of calls her out. He's like, no, there's not. Like, there's nobody there waiting for you at all. Like, this was your plan. This is all you have going for you.
And I love, so Samuel Jackson is seriously injured with his balls blown off. I mean, that's, you know, and I love that he is commentating from the background, like saying, Mannix, don't do this or whatever. Or like, laughing
slow-mo.
At him.
Like there are scenes, like he's doing things, like when they talk to Mannix and they're talking to Mannix and Domergue, like it's in standard speed.
Yeah.
But when they go back to Sam Jackson, like they slow it down.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if it's because like he's so injured that he is like that's his perception of what's going
probably.
On. But I thought that was kind
sometimes,
of
sometimes
cool,
like it's not always.
No.
They do go
like,
back
towards the end.
Like no, right, don't. Yeah. But I just love his little like peanut gallery. Like I told you. Or he's laughing at her and he's saying don't do this. I just think it's funny that he's so injured, but he's kind of in the background.
He's still doing his thing.
Yeah. It's
so Joe Gage is sitting there and he ends up going for a gun and it slows down in slow mo and then. Mannix ends up killing Joe Gage. They end up killing.
Well, I love that Mannix eventually says that he's not taking the deal.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
right.
She's like, "What are you talking about?" And she starts getting all flipping out. And he's like, "You were gonna let me drink that coffee."
Yeah.
So it all comes down to no matter what happens in the future, he's like, "You were gonna let me drink that coffee and die." So I'm not gonna save
you.
Yeah.
All I could think about was that scene in Dogma where they kill the entire, where Bartleby and Loki kill, or not Bart. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon kill that entire boardroom of people and they go back to shoot the woman and he's like, what did he do? She's like, you didn't say God bless you when I sneezed. And he's like, we're good. He's like, all right, fine. So they end up killing everybody and they're kind of leaning back and they kind of had this line about how Warren has a line where he's like, don't kill her. He's like, we got to do this for John. And he was like, what do you mean? He's like, she's going to hang.
Yeah.
And they're just, he's like, what? So they end up, the next scene, it cuts, and the next scene is her with
him. He said, we're both going to die, but you know what?
Yeah,
our last act is going to be.
Yeah, she's going to hang. Yeah.
And I love it. They're all bloodied, and they're on the bed, and they're pulling this rope together, and you can tell they're so injured. Great performances, both of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. And so they're both pulling this rope, and they tie it to the bedpost, and they're just laughing at her. And there was something satisfying, because you hate that Daisy Domer character
so
much.
Yeah, well, you don't, like, you know? It's weird that when the turn happens when she sees. You don't hate her as much until you watch her, until you realize that she knows that the coffee is poison, and then she's just as ruthless
as always.
Kills,
and she killed John Ruth,
right,
and you're just like,
she
oh,
cut
I hate
John
her.
Ruth's arm off.
Yeah.
So, like, you get that.
Oh, yeah, so they're scrapping and trying to get the gun or whatever, and she has this body she's dragging around,
right.
So she ends up just cutting
the...
Isn't there a sword on the mantle or something? Or
I don't
what
remember.
Does she
it doesn't
use?
Matter. Like,
but
yeah.
she, yeah, it's like...
It's a sword from Kill Bill.
Yeah.
It's a Hattori Hanzo sword.
Nice.
No, I don't know. That's not true. So that's kind of where we end our movie is there. Daisy dies, the hanger,
and then
you assume that they both.
Well, and then Mannix asks to read the Lincoln letter.
Right.
Which
I thought
was an odd way to go out because it goes out like it's this touching lesson, but it's like the letter's fake.
But I think it was just kind of like, let me see it.
Well, I like that.
And then he crumples
said,
it.
Was,
like,
he goes, old Mary Todd. That's a nice touch.
Right. And he crumples it up and tosses it.
Yeah.
To
and
me
I'm,
was
I'm
like,
glad they added that line about that's a nice touch because at that point I was almost wondering like, did the film
didn't
forget
he know
that,
it's fake? That
the letter's fake?
No, I think
right.
it just...
And, but I was glad I didn't... It removed that from the equation that he's like... And that this character remembers that the letter's
fake.
And then that's how our movie
And that's
ends.
How our movie ends.
Yeah.
Like, I was trying to think of, like, where this falls in the filmography of Tarantino. And to me, it's probably in my top four. Like, I loved this movie.
I think the writing was so good. It was such a clever, like, I love it when you can take a movie and put it in one room because, I mean, it's been done before.
Yeah, I mean, this is almost a stage play.
Yeah.
Yep.
And sometimes they're really bad and they fail, and sometimes they work. And this movie works because you don't need more scenery.
Reservoir Dogs was practically a stage.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs
right.
was, yeah, that's another
and
one.
And I love that. I just love that he can do that because Quentin Tarantino has this dialogue, and some people try to emulate it and you get these talkie movies that are clearly an homage or trying to do the Tarantino thing,
right?
But they're not Tarantino and they can't write like him, you know. The emulation is not as good, And so I love it when you see one of these things and you're like, yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. That's the, like,
that's
this
the guy
is...
that wrote True Romance. That's the guy that made Reservoir Dogs, had all those.
That's
Pulp
the guy
Fictions.
Who, I mean, who had that great quote in Crimson Tide.
Yeah. I didn't say that at the time, but
yeah,
he was also a script doctor on It's Pat. So let's not.
We can't all be winners.
Yeah. So exactly. So
now you know why Julia Sweeney was in Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That is a weird, where she walks out and was like, what are you
like,
doing
how
here?
How did this happen? Right. I just want to know how it happened.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. Yeah, I think, you know, if you have the time and you're willing, if, you know, obviously.
If you have the time to listen to these 3 hours of podcast, you can probably
watch
the movie.
Well, it's not just that. Like, I guess I've always felt like Tarantino has his audience.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's not a cross audience. Like, yeah. There are Tarantino people, and that's all he attracts.
Yeah.
But I say that, and then I realize that the show that you went to was sold out. The show I went to was sold out. The show that was after mine was sold out.
Well, I don't think that speaks to anything. I mean, honestly, this is a Tarantino movie in 100 theaters in the entire world. I mean, they're going to be sold out. There's 4 showtimes in a
day. The real test will be next week.
I guess that's
true. I don't think that says anything, but you got to remember, I mean, Tarantino has made some money. I mean, okay, I think Inglourious Basterds was incredibly wide appeal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't think there's... That wasn't a Tarantino audience. That was mass appeal. No, that transcended. Yeah. That was Brad Pitt. That's when it started. Well, I mean, Kill Bill was huge. I think that was a really big following.
Yeah.
But I think then that audience carried over. And
Pulp Fiction was a huge hit.
It was.
That was
$100 million. Do you think? Yeah. Do you think that Tarantino was the draw of Inglourious Basterds, or do you think it was Brad Pitt as that character?
I think a huge part.
I think it's both. I think Tarantino is certainly a draw. He's a director that can open a film.
Sure.
But
I think he's
Brad
the draw.
Pitt, it doesn't hurt.
He's the draw to Tarantino people that love Tarantino films.
Give that guy the Fantastic Four.
But when you have Brad Pitt in there, I think that character, and it was such a good character because it was at the time not a Brad Pitt
sir,
role.
I don't speak any Italian.
It wasn't a very Brad Pitt thing to do.
No.
Now Brad Pitt has turned into a different animal now, but back then it was like what a weird thing for him to do, and that's like. The highlight of the movie
I do
is
love
that character.
Movie. That movie is fantastic.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's Hateful Eight.
Yeah, do it. If you have the time, if you're willing to do it, it's amazing. It's so good.
Yeah. So I don't know what we're going to do next week, but
we never do.
We never do. But
that's
go
our
on,
New Year's resolution.
That's our new
figure out what we're going to do.
Start planning this show in advance. So. We'll go around the table and everybody can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21.
I'm Kevin Brackett. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. If you want to continue the conversation online, if you have thoughts about The Hateful Eight, if you've seen it, we welcome any and all.
Yeah, comers. I want to hear your thoughts.
So join us at facebook.com/realspoilers or email us at realspoilers@reviewstl.com or tweet us at realspoilers. Also, don't forget, we're available on the iTunes, so you can go there and subscribe and rate and review us. That helps a lot. We greatly appreciate it. And while you're on our Facebook page, if you like the episode, share it on your Facebook page so your friends can check it out. That helps us tremendously as well.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we greatly appreciate it.
We do.
So don't know what we're doing next week, but I'm sure we'll do something. Until next time, JB's death teaches Gillum to give up the guns.
Candy girl, if you got me wanting you, honey, sugar, sugar, you are my candy girl, and you got me wanting you. When I kissed you, girl, I knew how sweet a kiss could be.
I'm not as sweet a kiss can be.
Believe the one to love is feeling too.
Oh, your sweetness over me.
Oh,
I haven't bought underwear, and my mother's been dead for 7 years.
Huh. You haven't bought underwear in 7 years?
Yeah.
Well,
that's
totally
how much underwear I
you
have.
You only wear one pair a month.
I just wear the one.
So, I mean.
Just wear it till it wears out. Yeah.
But yeah, that's how
funny.
Much underwear there is. There's on Amazon Kindle sales today.
Yeah.
They have a bunch of Calvin and Hobbes on sale.
Oh.
And they have a bunch of Charlie Brown's on sale.
Oh, nice.
So last year for Christmas, I got that giant, like, 3-volume set.
Oh,
Calvin
yeah.
The complete Calvin Hobbes.
Yeah.
It's so good.
That'd be good in digital. I bet it looks really clean. It's probably really cool. I love that with cartoons like that where, I mean, even graphic novels, comic books, I mean, they just... The crispness and the colors, you know. I mean, I really like. I know there's something to hold in that page, but man, just I love how clean they look.
I hate it when Zach's like, "I don't like these Kindle. I want to hold a real book." I'm like, "Bitch, you're on your phone 24/7."
Yeah. Oh yeah. I would never go back to regular books after Kindle. I mean, you can read at night. You know. I mean, it's no lights.
True.
No. I mean, it's just so handy.
Yeah, it is nice.
And
if I want to read in bed after, and Crystal wants to sleep, I can just put it on black background with white text. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And plus traveling. So, do you want to bring the freaking, you know, hardcover Lord of the Rings anthology with you, or do you want to bring a little thin?
Yeah.
It is a catch 22 because I will never get a comic digitally. I just won't do it. Like, I don't like it. I don't want anything
to
do with it.
That's a collector in you, probably.
It is, but I also, I like the tactile nature of flipping a page in a comic book, and then, like, or, like, that the reveal. Sometimes I do that with a big reveal. That being said, though, like, I don't want to lug around. Like, if I want to read The Dark Knight, I don't want to lug around my absolute copy of it, you know? So, like, that makes sense. But, like, in issue format, I prefer to have it in issues, but like if I'm going to read a collection, I'll read it.
Like
on.
You said, double-edged sword. I do like buying those volumes though, where you can get a whole volume for $10 or $5 on sale.
Yeah, I was like, Tom sent me a big old thing for Star. They were doing a massive Star Wars sale, and unfortunately, I have all of the stuff on there. I had, but like they did there's a cool book called Star Wars Legacy that it's about Luke's great great grandson, and like his. Trying to either be a Jedi or a Sith, and he's like a drug addict.
So Rey's great grandson.
Yeah, right.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, I know they did a huge Dark Horse did a huge sale with the EU digitally, where it was like for $75, you got
the whole thing,
everything ever did.
Which is you got to cherry pick the shit out of that because some of it's really good and some of it's awful.
Yeah. And is that not canon anymore?
Not anymore.
That would bother me if I bought all those and I was like, oh, this is cool, and then it wasn't even real.
No,
I'd be
called
like,
Star Wars Legends.
Yeah,
now
they're just legends.
Yep.
Tales.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But for $75 for all of it,
that's
for like 15 years
worth of stuff.
And
it's a good deal, no doubt.
They were cranking that shit out because that's why I stopped collecting it. Because at first I was getting all that Dark Horse stuff.
Oh man,
I couldn't keep up. I'm like, okay, I'm out.
Yeah, they had Legacy, Knights of the Old Republic. They had all like different stories, people I don't even remember.
Yeah.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Okay, let's start on this. This is a 3-hour movie. Let's not make it a 3-hour podcast.
I thought that's what we were doing.
We did that last time.
Isn't it minute for minute on the movies now?
Here we go.